Welcome to Nonviolent Direct Action, where we examine the societal and personal ramifications of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s insight that to passively accept an unjust system is to cooperate with that system, and thereby to become a participant in its evil. I'm Nick Modern, host of Episode 7 in this series. Today, I'll be speaking with peace activist and nonviolent resistor Joy First. Joy is a PhD in women's studies. She is 64 years old with 5 children and 7 grandchildren. She's a doll maker and an activist who has been involved in nonviolent civil resistance since 2003. Since then, she has been arrested over 40 times in Wisconsin, Iowa, Maryland, and Washington, D.C., participating in nonviolent actions against U.S. wars. Joy is a member of Madison Pledge of Resistance, Wisconsin Network for Peace and Justice, Wisconsin Coalition to Ground the Drones and End the Wars, and the National Campaign for Nonviolent Resistance. Joy, thank you so much for being with us.
It's good to be here, Nick.
One of the things that struck me in your biography is that you're a grandmother. It's 15 years since you first became involved in nonviolent resistance. Would you tell us how old was your child or your children then, and what made you decide to undertake nonviolent civil resistance, and when did that first happen?
I actually started in 2003 in the run-up to the war in Iraq. And I know people all over the country, all over the world, were really concerned about Bush talking about going to war in Iraq. And so my husband and I went to all the marches, and we went to all the things that were going on in Madison at that time around speaking out against the war. One day I saw something on the website, the local peace group's website, the Madison Area Peace Coalition. And it was for training for nonviolent civil resistance. And I had the feeling that I needed to do more than I was doing. And so I went to that training. And from the first moment I went there, I just felt like this is what I need to be doing with my life. I'm not a religious person, but this just felt like almost like a spiritual calling that I needed to just be focusing on this war and doing everything I could, including putting my body on the line to try to stop it. And so this was the Iraq Pledge of Resistance, which put out that call to action. And the Iraq Pledge of Resistance actually became the National Campaign for Nonviolent Resistance, which I've been organizing with for the last 15 years now.
And at that time, how many kids did you have?
My kids were all born by then. I was in my 50s at that time. And my youngest child was just finishing college when I was arrested my first time, which was in Madison, Wisconsin, on the day that Bush launched what he called shock and awe.
And that was really the first day of violence in that war, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And there were actions of nonviolent civil resistance organized across the whole country by Iraq Pledge of Resistance.
Were your kids aware that you intended to do this? Did they have any comment on this?
Yeah, they were all aware of it, and my husband was aware of it. And I guess that's one thing that's just been really nice for me is that they've all been very supportive in me doing this and understand that this is what I need to be doing with my life, and they accept that. And I think they're not real happy with it sometimes. They do worry about me, but they know that this is what I need to do, and they support me in that.
Well, you've been arrested some 40 times. Is there any particular time that they tried to talk you out of it? Do you recall, or have they been pretty much, yeah, you do it and we'll, you know, back you up?
They've never really tried to talk me out of it. In some ways, I think it was a really good time in my life to get involved in this. You know, my children weren't little. You know, they didn't need the kind of care that I and the time I had to put in when they were younger. So they were all pretty independent at that time with their own lives. And so in some ways, I feel like I got started kind of late in doing this kind of work. But I guess there were reasons for that also, that I was in my 50s before I started doing this. a lot of people my age started doing nonviolent civil resistance or getting involved in political activism during the Vietnam War. I didn't start till later in my life, and I had some things going on. I had a difficult childhood. It was, my parents were very abusive, and so I didn't start dealing with that till I was 37 years old. And then I had to go to about 20 years of therapy to be in a place where I could really step out into the world and do the work that I felt like I needed to be doing.
I think a lot of times people who have been treated poorly, you know, when they're young, do have a keen interest in, you know, general social justice. And I think that can also be related to some kind of religious or spiritual experience with nature. Can you recall any certain things that were particularly that way that impelled you in this direction?
You know, I think you are right. As you know, as I went through my healing process, you know, to just see the what was going on in the world and the people suffering in the world and what could I do to stop it. So in 2000, I started working on my PhD in women's studies. And I quickly moved into focusing in the area of violence against women. My dissertation focused on interviews with women who had been sexually abused as children, who were now identified themselves as social justice activists working on violence against women. So that whole idea of social justice activism and what you can do to make the world a better place, I think it's been with me for a long time, though I haven't been able to manifest it until 2003 when I started getting really involved in with groups that did these risk arrest actions.
And did you encounter other women who were involved in anti-war work who discussed their lives with you? And were there things that you felt you had in common with them in terms of anti-war work? And the reason I ask that is because we are in a time, I think, when there are so many, I'd say, situations of great suffering being generated by our government in the United States as well as in other countries. And I think it's very challenging for anybody to continue to engage in this. And I think there are quite a number of women who are involved with anti-war work. And so I was wondering if you found things in common with these women that made you feel a sense of community in this particular kind of work, anti-war work.
I don't know if I've had a lot of talks with other women specifically in this area. You know, you do really form a really tight community when you do this work together, risking arrest. I guess I don't really think that I've had a lot of talks specifically with women like in what you're asking.
And when you say a tight community, could you explain that a little bit more? I think that's, community is very important to us in this time. So I wondered if you could talk about that a little bit.
As I started to go out to D.C. more and more, and I get out to D.C. about 3 or 4 times a year, and either involved in a risk arrest action or involved in a trial after we've been arrested. And as I started to go out there more and more and I got to know people, I started to realize, you know, this feels like my tribe out there. This feels like my family out there. This is who I belong to out there. And in some ways, I feel a little bit split because I've got my family here in Wisconsin that I just love to death, that I'm so connected with. But I go out there and there's a certain feeling that I have with these people out there because we do things together, you know, that we do things together that I never thought I would be doing, you know, walking into Congress and standing up to people, standing up to the Pentagon police when we go to the Pentagon, going to the White House. And I definitely go outside of my box where I feel safe when I do these things out there. But that really bonds you so closely, so tightly with the people that you do this with. That's what I mean about, you know, the community out there. You know, you get very, very, very close to these people that you do this work with over and over and over.
Can you recall any particular incidents or arrests, circumstances that stand out among the others? What comes most to your mind as this really changed me or changed something?
When I think about one of the arrest scenarios that really has meant the most to me, that felt like a very transformative experience in my life, it was in March of 2007. So, I mean, 11 years ago. It's a long time ago, but it still impacts me today. So if you think about what the situation was there, we had a midterm election in 2006. And in 2006, Bush was in the White House. We had a Republican Congress and a Republican House. And we had the election, and the Democrats won the House and the Senate at that time and took over. I think they won both houses. But at any rate, there were so many people that said, oh, great, now we're not going to be voting to fund the war anymore. The Democrats aren't going to fund Bush's war. So what happened in March, I was in Washington, and we were trying to determine what we were going to do. And it was kind of a different situation, because usually we would spend months planning an action. For some reason, we didn't know what we were going to do. And so I was there, and we're still kind of thinking about it. And we were meeting in the basement of a meeting house near just across the street from the Capitol. And we were planning an action to go to the Hart Senate office building. And my friend Pete Perry came to the meeting, and he said, the Senate is just voting to fund the war. And so we went over to the Hart Senate office building, and we had paper tombstones that we set up, and we stood there in the atrium of the Hart Senate office building, which is, you know, about 7 stories high when you're in the middle of the building in the atrium there. And it's just this huge space, and we're standing there, and we're reading names of Iraqi people and U.S. soldiers that have died in that war since the Democrats took control of Congress. And I was just standing there just crying. And it took a while for me to figure out exactly what I was doing and why I was doing this work. It's been a process unfolding to understand the meaning of it in my life. But at that moment in the Hart Senate office building, when the Democrats voted to fund the war, I realized that there's no place in the world I needed to be but here. I knew I wasn't there to try to get arrested. I knew I may get arrested, but that wasn't my goal. My goal was just to be there to speak out against these crimes that our government was committing. And, you know, it had been the Republicans, but now it was the Democrats as well. And if you think about now what's going on today, you know, everybody's so hopeful that the Democrats are going to take over Congress and that we'll have things better that are going on. But from my experience back in 2006, and knowing that both the Democrats and the Republicans are responsible for the situation we're in right now, Barack Obama continued the wars that Bush started and even added more to them, I think that we just have to think about that it's not going to be the government that changes things. It's we, the people, that have to stand up and take control and say, no, this is what we want. And we need a critical mass of people to do that.
That's really sort of the point of everything that you've been doing in a certain way, is to try to mobilize people in that direction. I want to just go back to a minute of your being in that atrium, because some people listening may not have been there, and it's a very large space. It could be 100 by 100, and every floor has a balcony that looks out onto this atrium. And in some ways, you could say it's almost like a theater, or like a church in the sense of its volume and its height. And I have been to protest there. I wondered if you could just say a little bit more about your experience of going into buildings like that in Washington, not only this particular one, which is very dramatic, but you've been in, I think most recently, office of Congressman Steny Hoyer, who is high up in the Democratic leadership. I mean, what's it like to go into these buildings that are very like, you know, marble, Romanesque, grand, busy, you know, that's part of this whole experience, don't you think?
It is, yeah. And, you know, there's so many people that go to Washington, D.C. as tourists to see all these buildings and the awe of it all. And, you know, I go into it, I think, feeling different than a lot of the tourists would go there feeling. It's always kind of scary because I know that I'm going to have to be speaking out. And basically, I'm kind of a scared, shy person. And so to walk into some of these buildings and know what I have to do, it's scary. And we're standing up against the biggest empire in the history of the world. And sometimes we've got 50 people going in. Sometimes we've got 10 people going in. And I feel like it's just really putting myself out there in a way that is very uncomfortable, but it also, in some ways, is also very empowering and is something that I just feel like I have to do. And, you know, like I always like to say that my grandchildren are just everything to me. I just want to spend every day with them. I just love to be with them so much. But as a grandmother, I also feel like it's important to spread my arms wide and embrace all the children of the world. And so that's what I think about when I go in there, is the importance of doing everything I can to alleviate the suffering of the children.
You're listening to Episode 7 of Nonviolent Direct Action. I'm host Nick Motter, and my guest today is peace activist and nonviolent resistor Joy First. Well, one thing, you know, in terms of when you say scared, I mean, we're talking about fear. And we're also, I think, talking about in a situation where one can't say, I think, generally, I went to this office and this member of Congress decided to change their mind and do what we were asking. And so I don't know if you are part of any religious group or what your spiritual religious practices are, but how do you restore your spirits? I'm sure being with your kids and grandchildren are part of that, but I just wonder, and how do you deal with these fears that I think are probably felt by many people?
Well, I am not part of any religious group, but I think of myself as a spiritual person. I live out in the woods now, and just being out here in the woods is just feels like a very spiritual way to live for me, and really can help to build me up, to give me the strength to kind of, when I have to go to D.C. and confront these things. And spending time with my grandchildren also does that. And the last time I went to Steny Hoyer's office, my granddaughter, she was 9 at the time, she gave me this little stone that she had painted, and she painted a peace symbol, the shape of a heart on one side, and on the other side, she painted a horseshoe, and she gave this to me, and she said, I know you're going out to Washington again, and I wanted to give you this to hold on to, and, you know, it's to give you courage and to give you good luck when you go out there. And, you know, it's just, yeah, things like that that really mean a lot to me and make me able to continue doing this. In some ways, you know, it feels like such a hopeless time right now. There's so much going on right now. So many people suffering in this country and overseas. But to me, I feel like it's so important to continue to have hope that we can make a difference. And I really hold on to that.
Also, you know, in your biography, you say you're a doll maker. And I wonder if you do that on a regular basis or whether you have any other art or creative things that you are involved with.
I do it on a regular basis. I've made a number of dolls. I call them spirit dolls. Yeah, that's another way to nurture and take care of myself, to give myself the strength to do this work.
Could you explain that doll to us, maybe a little bit how it looks, but what the whole idea of it is?
I call it the triple goddess, maiden, mother, moon. And so there's three dolls that make this up. And one doll is the maiden doll. She's the waxing moon. And so her body is actually shaped like the curve of the waxing moon. And so her arms are outstretched and over to the right. And so she's kind of got that shape, like that curve that the waxing moon would have. And then there's the mother doll in the middle, and she's got a big pregnant belly, and she's sitting down, and she's so to have that sort of that rounder look to her, like the full moon. And then there's the crone moon or the waning moon. And in that one, she's got a big hunchback, and she's standing so that the curve of her hunchback goes like the in the shape of the waning moon.
How big are these?
They're about maybe 8 or 10 inches tall. Yeah, made out of cloth that I sewed them.
When did you start that?
Oh, my first doll that I made like that was in the early 90s.
Are they all symbolic, emblematic of certain things?
Yeah, they are. The first doll that I made was actually part of healing from my childhood abuse. And they've all got a story to tell, a story behind them.
So how many have you made all together?
Maybe about 10 or 12, something like that.
And do your grandchildren, do they get to see them? They probably want to play with them, stuff like that.
They don't play with them. They see them, but they don't play with them.
Do you tell them stories in relation to it and things like that, I guess?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The question I have, and it goes back a little bit to earlier part of the interview, is there are many really demanding human issues, you know, human suffering right now with these deportations, with people being thrown in jail by ICE, more people coming from Central America to enter the U.S., and, of course, there are police killing, climate change. And I'm just wondering, have any people, anyone said, you know, to you, Joy, why are you involved with, you know, things going on outside this country, Afghanistan, war, Somalia, Yemen? You know, you need to focus here on more immediate issues. And, you know, I don't know if people have asked you that, but how do you feel about that?
I've thought about that a lot because there is so much going on in the world and right in our own country that, like you said, people are focusing on. I feel like it's really important for me to keep my focus on wars overseas for several reasons. First of all, I think a lot of people in this country don't pay attention to the fact that we are involved in several wars overseas. And as you said, we have bases and are involved militarily in way more countries than just several. So what we're doing over there is causing immense human suffering to the people of these countries. And because of the way we're doing it now, we're not paying attention here. So, you know, we used to have soldiers that would go over there and fight and die, and it would be our sons and our daughters who would do that. But we don't have that happening anymore in that way, where hundreds and thousands of our troops are getting killed in wars, because we're sending special ops over, because we've got the drone wars going. And so we're just dropping bombs on people in these countries from drones, or we're selling arms to different countries like Saudi Arabia so they can use them to kill other people. So the effects on people in this country aren't that devastating because of the wars that, I mean, in a way that we can make that clear connection. And so I think we can't forget about the people that our government is hurting. I think that we have to stand up and say that this isn't okay to be doing this. And the other thing that, you know, for people who are looking more at what's going on here, well, the amount of money that we spend on our wars is just crazy. It's over half of the U.S. government budget is spent on wars overseas. And if we could take that money and spend that on money on to help people here in different ways, you know, that would make a huge difference also. Like right now, what's going on in Yemen, the UN has said that is the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. And so we have to try to call that to people's attention and say, you know, this is what our government is doing. Look at this. And we have to stop this.
So let's take the example of Yemen. The U.S. is very involved with Saudi Arabia, and Donald Trump says that this has to do with them buying weapons. So it also has to do with oil. and us wanting them to help keep the world price of oil lower so it won't hurt, oil price won't hurt our economy. But for many people, I think the argument that the military is out there protecting America, that we have terrorists that who are always lurking, Trump says, coming into America through these refugees at the border. For many, many people, they're simply afraid. And when you say half the more than half the military budget goes for these wars, I've encountered people who say that really they don't care how much does it cost. And how do you respond to that? How do you think about people dealing with their fear about?
I think that's a really important question. There are a lot of people afraid and consider people from the Middle East or from Africa terrorists. And I think that one thing that is just critical, absolutely critical, is that somehow we become more educated and understand that we're killing women and children and men who haven't done anything. This is actually creating what we call terrorists. What we call terrorists, for the most part, are people who are trying to defend their homeland just as we would do if we had people attacking our country.
And can people just get over their fear? I mean, you evidently are not afraid of these people from other countries. And how did you get to the place where you're not afraid of them?
It's important to have that understanding of why people in other countries are angry with us. And I think that really also ties in closely to the idea of American exceptionalism, that we think that we're this exceptional country, this exceptional group of people, and that we don't do anything wrong. But we commit more war crimes than anybody in the history of the world, in my opinion. And we're the ones who are making the world unsafe. And I'm not sure how to help other people understand that. I think we've got to just open this conversation up. And it's important for people to see that.
Yeah, how did you come to see that yourself?
I think, starting out in 2003 and reading what was happening, what our country was doing, you know, you have to read things on like Common Dreams or Huffington Post or the Daily Beast or Truth Out or, you know, articles that are not in the mainstream media to get some really important analysis of really what's going on. And it's not what our government is trying to do. Our government works hard to try to keep us afraid, to try to keep these wars going, and that's not reality.
You're listening to Episode 7 of Nonviolent Direct Action. I'm host Nick Modern, and my guest today is peace activist and nonviolent resistor Joy First. Would you say that anything in your upbringing or people you have met who have inspired you would make you trusting in what you read in something like Common Dreams or Truth Out or some of these other places? Because, you know, as we know, there's a huge amount of controversy about who has the correct, you know, accurate information. And I know for me and other people, we've developed a certain list of sources of information that we trust. But other people could read the same thing and think it's a bunch of baloney. And So I was wondering if, you know, for you personally, can you look at different things that have made you think that these are reliable sources?
I'm not sure about that. I mean, when I got a lot more involved politically and I was reading these, I read everything on Common Dreams, and I didn't feel like I could trust the government. I know that. I think that the government lies to us a lot, and I'm not sure what it was in my experience that helped me to believe these more progressive ideas about what's going on.
Because I wondered, you know, in going to, you know, you got a PhD, you've been involved in various schools, and do you think those were influential in any way in forming your, let's say, your sorting process?
Oh, certainly. I could say the work on my PhD definitely helped me learn to really sift and winnow and listen to different people's viewpoints. You know, I think that's one of the things that the more conservative people don't do. They don't look at different people's viewpoints. And so in women's studies, for example, it was really important to not just look at the experience of white women, and we had to look at what's going on for African American women, for women in different places in the country, reading about women in Korea and how they fight against oppression. And yeah, I think it is critical to see a lot of different points of view like that and determine how that fits in with your view of the world and bring that in to influence you.
When you talked about, you know, how people are fighting for their rights in other places, that might be something that people here aren't familiar with, right?
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. I mean, that whole idea that the people in Yemen and Afghanistan and Iraq and all these different places that were at war, Somalia, whatever, people are people just like we are here with families they care about, with, you know, wanting to have a good life, wanting to have their rights preserved and be able to do what they need to do to make that good life for their family.
Are there any books that you would recommend to people?
Howard Zinn is amazing. If people haven't read The People's History of the United States, that's a really good place to start. But he's got a lot of other good writing. I mean, he's just one of my big heroes. And Gene Sharp, if you want to learn more about nonviolence, he's got some sort of more how-to books. And, you know, books about Martin Luther King can be very inspirational.
I think we mentioned that U.S. is the largest empire, certainly military force. So just for people who are wanting to think about this more, would you just give like a simple description of what is an empire?
I think for me, what makes it an empire is that we're reaching our tentacles all around the whole world and trying to control things all around the world, militarily and financially. And to me, that's what makes it an empire is, you know, you think about the Roman Empire was just in Rome and Italy, and they just spread and spread and spread. That's what the empires do, is spread around the world and try and take control of different places. And I can't remember the exact number. I think it's like 176. Like the United States has military bases in, and then fighting in all the wars that we're fighting in. And so, yeah, that to me is what makes us an empire.
I'm wondering how much the will among human beings to have an empire is something that's generated in men as compared to women. I wonder if women ran all the countries in the world and had done so for the last, you know, 500 years or more, would empire be an issue we're talking about? What, I mean, what do you think about that? Is it just like romantic nonsense that I'm bringing up here, or what?
I don't know. I mean, we've had some pretty brutal female leaders, if you think of Indira Gandhi and Golda Meir, and I think Hillary Clinton, too. I mean, she's a warmonger as good as the next guy. People think about women as being able to solve problems or be able to talk through things in a different way than men. And it's hard to say. So is women's ability to do that something that's socialized in them, or is it something that's inherent? It's possible. I mean, I think that women have been some really good leaders in working on peace, too.
I think that when it comes down to the day-to-day of doing the anti-war work, it seems to me that women are, I would say, by and large, better organizers than men in thinking about eventualities and how people will be affected by, you know, initiatives that folks are taking. Do you have any sense about that, just in terms of organizing this very, I'd say, difficult work of anti-war activity?
I do know a lot of really good women organizers, and I also know good male organizers, too. So I think that women are socialized to have some special skills that can really be helpful in this area. But like I said, there's also some men I know that are really good at it, too.
As far as the next step that we need to take after this election that comes up on November 6th, What do you think would be priorities of where, you know, how we should be moving in the next time after this election, regardless of who wins the election?
Well, you know, Howard Zinn had a quote that I can't remember exactly, but something about voting being marginally useful, and then the next day get out in the streets. And so, I mean, that is the issue, is that we have to get out into the streets. We have to get more people to be willing to get out in the streets, and young people to get out in the streets. There aren't a lot of young people involved in the anti-war movement. And I also think that working together, because all this stuff that's going on, whether it's the wars, the environment, you know, the Pentagon is the biggest polluter on the planet. So you can't really address environmental issues unless you address the Pentagon and the wars. What we're doing in our military overseas and overpowering and killing people is also affecting how the police are treating people at home and the police violence. And so all these issues are interrelated so closely. And, you know, we've got to reach out across to other people doing other things and say, let's work together. We've got to work together and make this world a better place. And that's, I think, the only way it's going to happen.
It's also going to be an issue of people's fears when it comes to getting into the street, isn't it?
Yeah, I think you're right about that. There is the fear. And then, like I can say from my own experience, I was sort of in this really wounded place where I wasn't able to get out and do this work till I was in my 50s. And how many other people are in that kind of situation? Or how many people are just so busy trying to make ends meet that they can't see themselves getting into the streets and doing anything? And so those things, yeah, along with the fear of what's going to happen in this situation where we have Trump, and there's this new thing that is just coming out where the National Park Service is trying to stop dissent around the White House. He definitely doesn't want people speaking out against him. And so it is scary, but we have to do it. We have to do this to make changes in the world.
You're listening to Episode 7 of Nonviolent Direct Action. I'm host Nick Motter, and my guest today is peace activist and nonviolent resistor Joy First. Joy, I think that if you could give any more thoughts or reflections about how people can deal with their fears, it may be very liberating, if you want to put it that way.
I guess I can just speak from my experience, and doing this work is the scariest thing I've ever done, but it's also the most empowering thing I've ever done. And I think for me, it's important to do what I can to set my fears aside and think about what's going on for other people in other parts of the world. So I've got this close friend, Malachi Kilbride, and we do a lot of planning and organizing together these actions of nonviolent civil resistance. And he said to me about 12 years ago, once you know, you can't not know. And the importance of that once you know what's going on, once you make yourself aware of what's going on, you can't not know that anymore. And then where that leads me to, on the next step, is you can't not do something about it. And even though it's scary, it's something that has to be addressed, something that we have to be doing.
And I read an article that said your daughter, one of your daughters, has also been involved with you in doing protests. Could you tell us a little bit about that? Because I think that she must have been paying attention to you.
Yeah, she was paying attention to me and really happy to see the things that I'm doing. And right now she's got a little 2-year-old and she really hasn't been so involved in activism lately. But then now my other daughter is talking to me that she'd like to go out with me to Washington, D.C. the next time I go and just be there and be part of it and see what happens. And I think that kind of speaks to the idea of people have different things going on in their lives at different times. And sometimes you can do this work and maybe sometimes you can't. For me personally, I don't see a time where I will not do this work again. It just seems like there's always going to be things that I'll need to be speaking out again.
Your daughter, you know, and daughters and kids seem to be very supportive, and your husband is supportive of this also. And I just wonder, over time, I mean, how do you think it's affected, you know, your relationship with your husband, with your kids, and how it would be different? You know, I don't know if you would want to speak to that, but I think that those are, you know, kind of fundamental things about how we live.
Since 2003, starting to grow at that time, that really this, my whole identity is as an activist. Or I shouldn't say my whole identity, but I will say that's a very, very critical part of my identity and who I am. And so it's not only my children who know and my husband who knows what I do, but my grandchildren who know what I do when they get to be an age where they can understand it. You know, like my granddaughter, you know, when she gave me that rock, she said, "And I just want you to know that I'm really, really proud of you and really proud of what you're doing." So it does have an impact on them. And I thought for a 9-year-old to say something like that was really, it really touched my heart. So my husband kind of keeps the home fires burning when I go out there and welcomes me home again. And he's just always been really supportive of whatever I felt like I've had to do in my life. And so here again with the activism, he's just right behind me and just, yeah, this is what you need to do, so you have to do it. And there's not really a question about it. So I feel like I'm really, really lucky in that way.
I guess I want to ask, too, about dealing with members of Congress. When you go into their office, do you discuss the role of empire? Do you have suggestions about what people can do in relation to the, you know, the question of empire? Is it only a matter of, you know, military activity? I'm just wondering if members of Congress are even open to hearing that word, empire.
A lot of times when we go into their offices, they might have a bill that's before the House or before the Senate. Like right now, there's a bill, I believe, before the Senate about selling arms to the Saudis. And so we go in and discuss things like that. It's important to keep on top of what kind of bills they're going to be voting on and try to talk to them about that. We talked to them about the empire and about war. And when we went to see Denny Hoyer, it was because he sidelined a bill in the House that could have helped in bringing an end to the suffering of the people of Yemen. And I don't remember what the number of that bill was, but so we walked in there and we had pictures of children who were suffering in the war in Yemen to remind his staff, to remind him that this is what's happening as a result of the U.S. war making. So we do definitely talk to them about that kind of thing.
Yeah, because the press isn't really providing us with these kind of images.
No.
And so I think what you're saying is that you connect the impact of the military, let's say military activity is central to empire. And what you're doing is trying to emotionally connect these people, any people, with the suffering that's being generated. And are there other ways you do that? Or?
Well, I don't think I can do it without doing that, or I don't think I want to do it without doing that. You know, you can look at the big political picture and that type of thing. But for me, what really matters, why I really feel like I'm compelled to do this work, is because people are suffering and dying. And it's all totally preventable. It's all because of what our government is doing over there. And it just feels like a very personal issue to me to do whatever I can to bring that message to, whether it's a congressperson or the president or the Pentagon or the NSA or the Department of Justice or just any number of places that we've been where we've risked arrest in Washington. It just feels like to bring that personal side in there is what really matters to me.
Because I know that in some protests, when people bring pictures of children who've died or other things that are really quite like gory, I mean, and horrible, other people in the rally say, "Oh, well, that'll offend people." But what I think what you're saying is that you really have to maybe shock people about suffering. Am I right, or am I getting mixed up?
I don't know if I would want to use the word shock, but I think we are just very insulated from what's happening over there. And I think that's one thing that, you know, you hear about with Vietnam, that we saw the news every day over there and pictures of people suffering and dying. And now we're not seeing that on our media. The average person, if you don't go to some kind of alternative media, you don't see anything about what's going on over there. And I just read an article that Trump is dropping a bomb every 12 minutes somewhere in the world. He's dropping a bomb, killing people. Every 12 minutes, we have to open our eyes and see what our government's doing and do everything we can to try to stop that.
Okay, well, I really appreciate speaking with you about, you know, very personal things as well as, say, larger political questions. And I wonder if there's anything that we haven't covered that you would like to say in closing today.
I guess what I'd like to say in closing is that we have the power to bring change. We, the people, have the power to bring change. And we have to get out there and do it.
Do you feel that people have that sense of their own power in this country? I mean,
well, I think we're actually quite a ways from it. You know, more people are getting involved in activism. I guess more people are involved in activism than ever have been before since Donald Trump became president. But yeah, we have to learn how to connect all the issues and work together to bring real change. And we really need sort of a critical mass of people in order to do that. And that's kind of the struggle. I mean, in some ways, I feel like we've kind of tried to keep things going, especially during the Obama years when nobody thought wars were happening, which is totally not true. But we need to bring people together now and work together on these issues.
You've been listening to Episode 7 of Nonviolent Direct Action. I'm host Nick Modern, and my guest has been peace activist and nonviolent resistor Joy First. You can find this episode and the entire Nonviolent Direct Action series on iTunes. You can find related links on our blog, nonviolentdirectaction.blogspot.com. Thanks for listening.